Gavin Wood's Countdown Podcast, proudly brought to you by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hi, this is John Stevens, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's Countdown Podcast. Enjoy.
From New Zealand to Australia, from Noiseworks, Jesus Christ Superstar, INXS, The Dead Daisies, and a huge solo career, it gives me great pleasure to say hello to John Stevens. G'day, John.
Hey, Gav. How are you, mate?
I'm fine, mate. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I've been watching your career for a very, very long time.
Yeah, I suppose it has been a while now. We're both great survivors of our industry, and what an amazing journey it's been for both of us.
Yeah, we're still here now.
Yep.
Let's go back to those early New Zealand days before you grew up and became a muso and a singer and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Where were you born?
I was born in a small town called Upper Hutt, about 30 miles out of Wellington, which is the capital city, bottom of the North Island, very tip of the North Island. I'm the youngest of 11 children, and, you know, I grew up in a pretty sort of free time and life. You know, we roamed a lot in the bush, down the rivers, in the ocean. There was a lot of freedom back in, you know, 60s and 70s, so it was like completely opposite to now. But, you know, I grew up in a great, great place, really, really, really cool place and beautiful place. And, you know, just, yeah, musical family, always around music. Everyone always sang and played. And, you know, with 10 siblings, I just grew up hearing every type of music, you know, from Mahalia Jackson, you know, to Perry Como, to the Rolling Stones, to the Beatles, the Kinks. I mean, you name it, Led Zeppelin. I heard it all because my sisters and brothers, you know, were always smashing that stuff out, you know. And my oldest brother had bands, and they used to rehearse on our front lawn. So I'd be like 4 years old and 5 years old, you know, watching, you know, musicians play.
So what number, out of the 11, what number were you?
I'm the 11th. I'm number 11.
You're the sport one then.
So they say, but not really. You know, as a... Now, there's a pecking order. When you've got that many siblings, there's a pecking order. And you know your place in the pecking order, especially with brothers, you know, older brothers. You know, so,
I'm sure.
Yeah.
It would have been great, you know, around the lounge room when you all got to sing. That would have been sensational.
Oh, unreal. We, you know, always every week there's some sort of sing-along, you know. The carousing, the drinking and the singing and the, you know, carousing was pretty normal.
Now, did you all have to have a party piece?
No, although my dad, when he used to have friends over, you know, used to get us up out of bed when we were like little kids and make us sing. You know, we'd get like a shilling or, you know, a couple of pennies, because it was pennies and shillings back in those days. So, you know, it's pretty
interesting.
You grew up in New Zealand, and your career started in New Zealand. So did it start at school? Did you?
Yes, it did. I had my first band at school when I was 12. And you know, we used to sing at school assemblies and stuff. Mark Southern was playing guitar, and Charles, I can't remember his first name. Anyway, little three-piece band, and we used to flail about. And then, you know, I ended up being expelled from school when I was like 14.
Oh, okay. Should we go into that? Should we investigate that?
Oh, no. Well, the back in those days, you know, you used to get the cane, you know, big, thick piece of bamboo that they used to hit you with, or the strap, which was, you know, half-inch thick leather strap that they used to wind up on you on that.
I've had both of those.
Yeah, so, you know, coming from that era where it was normal to, you know, beat students and if you did something wrong. So anyway, I got three of the best, and the teacher wanted to give me more, and I said no, and he, you know, blew a fuse and started coming at me, and I just, you know, said, better back up, I'm going to knock you out.
Good on you.
So I got expelled for threatening the teacher.
Yeah.
After he had, you know, hit me and wanted to hit me some more.
I know. It was brutal days back then, man. It really was.
It was, yeah. It was. So, you know, I'm 14, just 14 and a half. I wasn't even, you know, it wasn't even legal to leave school.
Right.
So I went and, you know, I got a job the very next day. Back in those days, you could get, you know, work anywhere. Plenty of work around. So I just went and got a job in a factory down the road and started paying my way, and, you know, from that day forward, as my father said, you know, you're a man now, you're paying your own way. So, you know, you're paying rent, you're paying your bills, you know, from day one. So that was that. You know, I ended up working at EMI records at when I was 15, pressing albums, actually in the factory.
What a great job!
Yeah, it was fantastic. Yeah, and you know, all those, I've still got all the labels that I of the records that I pressed, like, you know, thousands of albums, and so that was an experience. And then, well, when I was 15 and working at EMI, a friend of ours put us, myself and two of my sisters, in a talent quest, unbeknownst to us. But, you know, we did it anyway for fun, and we ended up winning this talent quest. And
right.
The fellow at EMI said, oh, I heard you guys sing, I'll put you in the studio. So he took us in the studio, and then EMI London actually wanted to sign us on hearing the tapes. Actually wanted to sign me, and I said, nah. There's a fellow called Mike Wells who was the head of EMI in London. And, you know, I wasn't interested in that at all. It was just a bit of a fun ride at the time. And then, you know, I was playing footy and rugby league. And, you know, I was just with my mates, hanging with my mates. I wasn't really interested in pursuing a music career. I didn't really know what that was. And so, you know, roll forward about, I was 16 years old. I came to Australia, to Adelaide, where I had a couple of sisters living in Adelaide. And, I went to the Archie Bar in Adelaide, and I saw the Angels play, and I'm like, holy crap, what is that?
Yeah.
You know, it was Doc in full flight, you know, with that, back in the very early days, 78, I think, 77.
What a great man, Doc. 78.
Indeed. And, you know, roll forward years later, I end up, you know, doing a few tours with them, and it's just fantastic. And, but, you know, that I saw the Angels, and the energy that they had was just blew my mind. And,
yeah.
I thought, man, that's the kind of band I want to be in, that kind of vibe, you know. And it was funny because the Archibars or the Angels for the very, very, very first time, never heard of them, and just went there chasing girls. And Dragon were playing the very next night. And so that was it was a good thing. And then I went back to New Zealand, and my eldest sister had a friend who worked in a studio in the city, a recording studio. And he was looking for a singer to sing some demos. And she said, oh, my brother sings. So he said, I'll bring him in. I'll give him a try. And now you got to remember, in those days, like, we didn't ever have a telephone. We didn't have a car. Didn't have a telephone. We lived out in the sticks.
Yeah.
You know, so my sister picked me up and took me in there. And I was very, very, very shy. If I'd known him, I was very shy. I wouldn't even talk, you know. And, you know, this guy, Steve Robinson, he played me a couple of songs, and I learnt the songs and I sang them. It's four songs, actually. I walked in, sang the songs, and walked out. And, you know, another year goes by.
Right.
And he threw my sister, he says, oh, listen, you know, can we send these songs to CBS? And I didn't know what CBS was. I'm like, whatever, man. My sister was asking me. I said, whatever, you know. And CBS heard them, loved them. And, you know, I wasn't interested. And they actually... I want to put out this song called Jezebel that you did.
Right.
This is like a year and a bit later. And I'm like, whatever, man. I don't really care. I'm not interested. I was not interested in it. And I was playing footy, having a great time, hanging out with my mates. And anyway, they put this thing out. I wasn't signed to them at all. There's nothing. And this song went to number one within 3 weeks and became the longest running number one in New Zealand recording
history. Wow. What a start to your career, man. That's brilliant.
Yeah, but the thing is, I wasn't, it was a shock. Yeah. It wasn't something I pursued. It was something that I did like a year before, one night over a course of a couple of hours, and it changed the course of my life.
Yeah.
And, you know, because, you know, when you're that young, 16, 17, you know, you just, you know, it's all, everything's an adventure. You just go along for the ride.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So, you know, that was how it started. And then, so I just dived in there and you know, learnt on the run, as you do.
Yeah. So you ended up with two number ones in New Zealand.
I did, yeah. We recorded an album, very quickly, and we did a song called Montego Bay. And whilst Jezebel was still sitting at number one, we put out Montego Bay and knocked it off number one. So they swapped positions. So it was a pretty heady time. There's, you know, it was kind of like, you know, Justin Bieber of New Zealand for about a year.
Yeah.
And then everyone, then I was sick of me. Everyone was sick of me. I was so oversaturated, and I was just everywhere, and it's a tiny country, and you can't
yeah.
hide.
Yeah.
I kind of learnt at a very young age, you know, what being overexposed was all about, and how people turn on you. You go from being, you know, this amazing, like, young, you know, singer everyone loves, to being like, oh God, I'm sick of this bloke. You know, because
yeah, I can imagine. All of a sudden, you're the big fish in the small pond. So,
yeah.
So by 81, it was time for you to move off and come over to the big island.
Yeah, well, I went to America first. I went to America and made a second album. I left New Zealand, came back to Sydney actually for about 3 weeks, and then went to America for almost a year in early.
Is that when you tried to get American citizenship?
No. No, not back then. No, okay. I had a green card years later.
Right.
Yeah. Because I lived there with my family, with my kids and my wife.
Right.
In the '90s, but that's another story. But you know, back in the '80s, it was I made an album over there.
Yeah, it was Stuart Fraser, was it?
And that was pre-Stuart Fraser. I did two solo records before I came back to Australia and started Noiseworks. And I met Stuart Fraser, I came back to Australia at the end of 81, and met Stuart Fraser on Melbourne Cup Day, 1982, because I just flailed around Australia Sydney for a bit, and then, we met Melbourne Cup Day 82 and started Noiseworks.
So how did you come up with the name Noiseworks? I've always wanted to ask you that.
We're going to call ourselves DreamWorks, and... Stuart Fraser. We all sort of went, we like DreamWorks. That sounds kind of, you know, trippy. And Stuart Fraser went, oh, fuck that. We should be fucking Noiseworks. And we're like, Noiseworks? Oh, that's even better.
It works
and that
well.
It was really that cut and dried. You went, no, fuck that.
Yeah.
Noiseworks.
Yeah.
And
you always know when it's a good name, don't you?
Yeah, you do. So it stuck.
Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives since 1934. Visit tobinbrothers.com.au.
Hi, this is John Stevens, and you're listening to the Gavin Woods Countdown Podcast. Enjoy.
And then Noiseworks had a great long touring career, record career. It was it was like Australia's premier rock band, really, wasn't it? It was full on. I loved it.
Yeah, you know. It was at a time, you know, at that time in the '80s, you know, when you got all the classic bands that were, you know, were from NXS to, you know, Cold Chisels and the Angels. Yeah. I mean, it was just so, the Vinyls, I mean, just so much talent, the Sunny Boys. And it was just an incredible time in Australian music, pub rock scene, which, you know, at the time, you know, when thinking back on it, it was just amazing. You know, we were playing like six nights a week to, like, you know, you go into these beer bars with 1,500 people, and people just like mosh pitting, you know, sweating sweat. There was actual gigs where the condensation was so much it would be raining inside. You know, you got people just going nuts. I mean, it was crazy days. Looking back on it,
I remember places like the Village Green. You know, your feet would stick to the carpet because they couldn't get the beer out from the last 6 months.
Hey, it hasn't changed.
There'd be so much smoke in the room.
Yeah.
And then the band comes on and everybody jumps up and down. It was just like a magical time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, you know. The music went along with it, you know. And all those, you know, the bands, you know, that's where you learnt your trade, you know, playing live. Because the thing was, actually, one of Noiseworks' first tours was with the Angels. And honestly, we were so, like, scared down that first gig because we're a big fan. So we knew what the volatility of the crowd was.
Yeah.
They didn't like you. You just get shit thrown at you.
That all go to the bar.
That all go to the bar, you know. But, you know, we actually got an encore. And that really sort of made us confident in our ability to play live, you know. Because up to that point, it was like, you know, when you're standing in front of an Angels crowd, you know, it's pretty intense.
I'll say.
You know, and that's, you know, we felt like we'd sort of arrived when we played that first gig.
Yeah.
Getting through that first gig and getting an encore and everyone's just going nuts. We thought, well, okay, we've got something here.
This is it.
You know.
Well, between 87 and 91, you had three platinum albums and a greatest hits album in 92. I mean, that's pushing them out and selling a lot of albums.
Yeah, there was, I think, 92, there was Jesus Christ Superstar album, which was number one, and the Noiseworks, Essential Noiseworks, was number two there for quite some time. So it was, pretty exciting days. But, you know, like everything goes up. What goes up must come down. And these are the lessons you learn right along the way.
Yeah, that's true. But you always got to be positive about it. Now,
you do.
Jesus Christ Superstar, you played Judas in Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yes.
Quite a demanding role.
Mm.
And what a cast.
Unbelievable cast. I mean, you know, Harry M. Miller, who put it all together. Genius, you know, for getting proper rock singers to sing a proper rock musical. That's how it was written. You know, for the first time, there was actually a cast that had all the credentials, you know, from John Farnham, Kate Sobrano, myself, Angry Anderson, you know, John Waters came in, Russell Morris, you know, was playing.
A stellar cast. Just the cream of Australian music.
Yeah.
I wore out my first Jesus Christ Superstar album. I just absolutely adored it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when the Australian recording came, I wore out that album as well.
Yeah.
And it was so good. It, you know, went straight to number one. I think it was the highest selling album.
That's right.
In the year of 92, correct?
Correct. Yeah. Noiseworks was the second.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The 1-2.
Yeah.
Man, well done.
Yeah, big year.
Yeah, I'll say.
Yeah.
Now, and then you toured with Jesus Christ Superstar all around Australia and just knocked people out. Did you enjoy that stage experience?
Yeah, it was like, you know, we did arenas everywhere, so and it was in the round. So it was like a first. There was a lot of firsts on that tour. It was the first time in-ear monitors, monitors had been used.
Okay.
On a across the stage with musicians and a lot of singers and all, you know, everything was happening and radio mics and all that stuff. They were like new at the time, you know.
Right.
So, and also it held, you know, it broke all the box office records at the time. It was the biggest selling tour in the world.
Wow.
At that time. And we did 89 shows, I think, in Australia.
Yeah.
And it still holds, you know, the box office record. Say, like at Rod Laver, you know, I think we did 28 shows in a row or something. And Sydney Entertainment said we did like 30 shows in a row. I mean, you know, unheard of sort of numbers at the time.
Yeah.
I don't think anything's done that many since, you know.
No, I spoke to Kate Sobrano on an earlier podcast. And she still says that's, you know, one of the big highlights of her musical career.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And same. I have to, say the same. It was really, really an amazing time in Australian music. And certainly for theatre production, it was the first time a theatre show had ever been done in an arena setting.
Yes, yeah.
And
yeah.
And that's, you know, the vision of Harry M. Miller.
Yes.
He was really dogmatic about in putting it on this way and making it happen this way. And we were actually only originally going to do, I think we were only signed for three shows, you know, they put them out in sale, and I think they sold like 22 shows in within a week. And so we all had to renegotiate, which was really good at the time.
Oh, that's nice. That's even better. Harry M. Miller did, of course, the first tour of Jesus Christ Superstar, you know, with John English and Marsha Hines, you know, the first... groundbreaking play.
He did Hair as well back in the 70s.
Yeah, just amazing guy.
Yeah, fabulous fella.
So speaking of another amazing guy, around that time you toured with your brother, Frankie.
Well, yeah, so I think we did 92 with the arena version, and then in 94 they had already put on a production of Jesus Christ Superstar in New Zealand.
Uh-huh.
And they asked me to be involved, but I couldn't. It was such a, I think they went played there for a year or something.
Right.
But they eventually came to Australia and they asked me to do it in Australia, and I did. I just spent 8 months doing, you know, 8 shows a week.
Gee.
Of the theatre production. But the one thing, and I told Harry this when we did the 92 production, I said, my brother, Frank, it would be the best Caiaphas you've ever heard. And at the time, they'd already picked somebody to play Caiaphas in the arena version.
Right.
So, you know, when he did the theatre version, and he called me, he said, give me your brother's number, I want to hear him. So, and my brother was amazing as Caiaphas in the theatre production. But, and it was great for me to spend, so long, that amount of time with him touring around, because, you know, he left home when I was 6 years old.
Oh, no.
He left in 1967.
He went to England.
He left New Zealand. He came to Australia first.
Oh, okay.
He was in a band in Sydney called The Castaways.
Uh-huh.
So, and then, you know, by 1970, I think he went to England.
69.
He's very successful, overseas, your brother, Frankie.
Yeah, back in the early days. So, you know, he was this guy that had left when I was six years old, and, you know, we'd talk to him on the phone down the neighbor's house every now and again when he'd call. For a special occasion or whatever, but otherwise he was just a mythical guy.
Yeah.
That I, you know, grew up going, oh, my brother's doing all this. What is he doing? He's in Hawaii, he's in London. Oh, that sounds pretty amazing, but, you know, you're a kid, you don't really care, but it sounds good.
And then you caught up on everything when you toured with him.
Years later, when we toured, it was a great time. You know, we just rented a house everywhere we went and just hung out. And, you know, it was great. It was a great time for, you know, to be brothers.
Yeah. How do you cope with 8 shows a week? That sounds like a big workload to me.
Yeah, it's certainly playing Judas. It was very, very full on. Look, you know, it's like anything, you know. I mean, I've done that many shows, you know, mentally, you know, you got to be up every night. I mean, every show to me is like grand final. It's like you can't afford to have an off night. And my off nights, people don't realize, you know, that I'm having them, because I never let on. You know, you got to give everything you have in the tank, you know, and I'm not one to let people down. I can't do that. And I can't be half-assed. I'm just not made that way. I'm an all or nothing kind of guy. So 8 shows a week, you know, was 8 shows a week, whatever, man. You know, I never had a show off, ever. Never taken a show off.
Wow. That just goes to show you've got well-worn pipes and good pipes that'll last.
Yeah, you know, touch wood, though. You know, certainly, I've certainly gotten better. I feel like I'm a way better singer than I was back then. I just am. You know, and it's like even, I think last year, I'm running out of time here. Yeah, beginning of last year, I did a couple of shows with Farnham, you know, and I think John's about 72 now or something. He's astounding. His voice is still the same. It's like, I just look at him and wonder. You know what I mean? It's just like, man. Yeah. And he, you know, he's so self-deprecating. He's like, it's amazing. What an instrument, you know? And I love that he's, you know, still as good as, you know, he was 50 years ago, you know? And for me right now, today, that's how I feel. You know, I'm better than I was 30 years ago.
I always tell the story, John, at the Countdown Arena Spectacular, when Bertel, Shorrock and Goebel were on the bill. And John Paul Young. So I'm standing side stage with John Paul Young, and John's just gone, "That bastard." And I've gone, "What? What do you mean?" He said, "Bloody Shorrock." He said, "He gets up there, he sings like a bird every night. He goes to the party, has a few drinks." He said, "And he's been doing it for all these years, and he hasn't dropped, you know, one note. He's just brilliant." And I looked at John and I said, "But you're the same." And he looked and he went, "Oh, I suppose I am."
Yeah, no, and look, you know, I remember in Jesus Christ Superstar, we, you know, have dressing rooms always next door to each other, you know. And and we used to sit there and he would have the brandy, I would have the red wine, and we'd both sit there and smoke cigars.
Yes.
He would pull out his cigars. We'd just sit there smoking cigars, and, you know, and it was cigarettes. And, oh, you just go, "What? You smoke cigarettes too?"
Yeah.
You know, it's like, gee whiz. It's
just the rock and roll tour, mate.
back in the day.
And then after that, you recorded a song called "I Wish It Would Rain" for the Farmers. Tell me all about that.
Yeah, it was an old Four Tops song, which I grew up listening to. And, you know, when that first drought happened, I think it was 1994.
Yeah, around there,
That first drought was so devastating, and, you know, I just thought, man, you know, let's just do that song. And so I did it with actually Paul Gray from Wawa, and he produced it. And, you know, Paul was an...
Oh, from Wawa.
Yeah, rest in peace, Paul. He was an old friend of mine, and an amazing musician, wonderful singer, just a fabulous guy.
Yeah.
You know, really, yeah, really good fella. So, you know, he produced that for me, and I, you know, I'm really proud of that song, the way it came out, because it's, you know, it's hard to do a soul song when you're a rock singer.
Yeah, of course.
You know
of
what
course,
I mean? That's,
yeah.
But, you know, considering what we did, Wish It Would Rain For, you know, it was good. It came out.
And all the proceeds went to the farmers, so well done to you.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
And then another one, you did a Frankie Goes to Hollywood song, that magnificent song, Two Tribes Go to War, and then the rugby league took it up.
Yeah, well, it was actually, I was living in America at that time, funnily enough, and I think it was 1997. And
yeah, it was.
Yeah, the NRL and Super League came out, and there was a big split in the whole game at the time, and Super League, you know, getting a big toehold in there, and
they wanted a big song.
They wanted the big song, and they flew me back from America, and said, "We want you to, you know, be the face of the, you know, the Super League with the Two Tribes thing." So I said, "Man, I love this song." So yeah, no problem. It's just, you know, just a
fired up a nation, I can tell you.
yeah. So and actually, my brother Frank is singing background vocals.
Oh, how
song.
Cool!
So I did that in Sydney. Yeah, he was in Sydney at the time. So yeah, that was a great time. And I was, you know, fronting, you know, my favourite game, you know, which was
absolutely
rugby league.
And then you wrote a song for the torch relay for the Sydney 2000 Olympics, Carry the Flame.
Yeah, it's a song that I'd written on an album I did with in America with Randy Jackson, who later went on to become a judge in American Idol.
American Idol.
Yeah,
yeah.
The first one. It's uncanny, that fella. But him and I...
He's a good bass player and a good producer.
He's amazing, yeah. Amazing musician, amazing. You know, him and I have been friends for years, and since the Noiseworks days. And I'd written this album, Circle, and one of the songs was called Carry the Flame.
Right.
And so that's 97, roll forward to, you know, year 2000, and a lady who was involved in the Olympics had asked me if I'd rewrite it.
Yeah.
And put it in as a, you know, potential Olympic song. And so I did. And they all loved it and all that stuff. And it was quite funny because I was actually slated to be performing at the opening ceremony, Carry the Flame. And SOCOG, the Olympic organization, wanted me to sign all rights over to them for the song. So basically I'd written, produced a song. It's my song, da da da. Oh no, but you'll give it to us. I said, well, you know, yeah, there is a commercial, you know, aspect to this. I said, no, we want it for free, forever, forever, amen. And I remember having a conversation with the lawyer, the so-called lawyer,
no,
who said to me, if you don't sign, yeah, your performance at the opening ceremony of the Olympics will be in jeopardy. So
that's extortion, man.
I said, really? And I, without a word of a lie, I said, really? And he goes, yep. I said, you can shove it up your ass.
Yeah, good on you.
That's exactly what I said. Shove it up your ass. And, yeah, that was the end of that. Meanwhile, there's another organization part of it called the Torch Relay aspect of it, which was not, it was Australian based, I guess. And the lady there was so nice, and I said, you guys can have it. And I gave it to them for free, but not for the life of the copyright, but just to utilize. So, you know, so I didn't get to do the opening ceremony, but I did get to do the closing ceremony via, with NXS, which was kind of interesting because, yeah.
Yeah, you won.
Yeah, funny day.
You won.
Yeah, no. Well, you know, it just came around that way. You know, I'll never forget that.
But, John, that's the problem with the industry. You know, you get talent shows that make these wide-eyed young little singers,
yes,
sign a contract and sign all their songs that they sing. They sign it away,
yes,
for perpetuity.
Oh, yes, forever, amen. Yeah, that's a terrible
wrong
thing.
It's just wrong, and people don't know about it.
No, they don't. You know, the 360 deals, all that stuff they talk about, labels. It's terrible, but, you know.
Well, it's theft. It's theft of somebody's art. That's what it is.
It's abuse, yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's get out of that stuff. Now, tell me about the In Excess and the three, what is it, the 3.5 years you toured America. Man, that must have been a slog.
Look, we toured America, we toured South America, we toured Europe, UK, I mean, everywhere, all around the world, Ireland, I mean, everywhere. And it was just fantastic, you know. I've got to say, it was, you know, it was never meant to be anything other than one show. And a bit of fun, because, you know, the boys were actually playing arena show with Tim Rice, the music of Tim Rice and Lloyd Webber.
Really?
And they were the house band. Yeah.
Oh,
they were the house band.
Oh,
and I think Kate Sabrano was part of that. And they did ask me to be a part of it, but I couldn't come to an agreement with them. So not In Excess. I mean, the people who put on the show.
Yeah.
So I said no. But meanwhile, you know, they were playing in Melbourne, and I happened to be in Melbourne, and the boys, I went to the show to see them, and they were all like really just bored, shitless, and they said, "Man, we want to do a little, let's do a gig. Come on, John, let's come, we're going to organize a gig, come and sing."
Yeah.
And so, you know, within a couple of days, there was a gig organized in Melbourne, we had one rehearsal, and you know, I wrote out all the words to the song, the set list, 23 songs. And basically, we sang. We got up there and I sang all the songs, and they were like, "Holy hell, we haven't heard these melodies sing right for a few years now."
Right.
Because I just sang them like the records, you know.
Yeah.
And it was great, and we had a great vibe, and one gig turned into two gigs, which turned into a tour here and a tour in New Zealand. I mean, all over the place, and then we just went full on. I was asked to join the band, so
it was a hot band. I saw their last show with JD Fortune at the Wilton on
speaking of TV shows.
And went backstage and saw the boys, but JD was I think he was floating above the crowd at the time, but there was you know, there was a little bit of Michael I saw in him. And And I thought, you know, you just brought the show.
Mm.
Whereas he was a bit, you know, a bit Hollywood.
It's called, rock star. They call it playing rock star, and, you know.
Yeah, and
it's a dangerous game if you're gonna, you know, play it like that.
Well, that's right. At the end of the day, it's a job, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and you owe it to the fans to show up every night. You know, if you're going to get off your face and fall off stage or be half-assed, you know, well, you're doing yourself a disservice. And I'm not saying I've never done that. I've hit the stage a couple of times after too many drinks. But, you know, you've got to do your best, man. But when you're at a certain level, you just really never show up.
Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hi, this is John Stevens, and you're listening to Evan Wood's Countdown Podcast. Enjoy.
So when the 2004, when the In Excess gig finished, you got straight into your solo career. So well done to that. And you started a tour, you know, as John Stevens, and put out some great albums. Testify, Ain't No Life for the Faint-Hearted, you know. And you even did an acoustic album too, which is one of my favourite albums.
Yeah, thanks. I actually did a tour as well with Ian Moss, and we did Six Strings in the Works. Mm. He had an acoustic album called Six Strings, and obviously our mom was called The Works. And we spent about 6 months going around Australia, the two of us, and just playing acoustic shows everywhere from Broome, right, you know, Kununurra, obscure places from one end, you know, from Darwin all the way around Australia, all the way back up to Cairns type thing, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's still one of my favorite touring experiences of my life was, you know, driving through the, you know, the outback of Australia, places that you just never get to. Places like Halls Creek, you know, like Halls Creek, where the hell's that? You know what I mean?
And aren't they so appreciative?
Oh my God, just so, so appreciative. Just amazing. So I've been really wanting to do that again one of these days. That was in 2006 or 2005, something like that.
After the noise of Noiseworks and In Excess And now you're doing acoustic shows. I mean, Billy Thorpe got into that, you know, at the end of his career, and he really dug it too. It's that intimacy between you and the audience. You know, they're right there.
Yeah, and you know what? Acoustic, you can't hide. There's nowhere to hide, you know. You're stripped naked, and it's a whole different, it's a different discipline. And vocally, it's a different thing as well, because, you know, when you're in a rock band, you tend to push harder.
Right.
When you got all the instruments flailing away, you know. Whereas acoustically, you know, you can't really, you got to move in and out in a different way. And sometimes, you know, it's actually more powerful.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you're right.
I love both formats. I mean, I became, you know, I did a lot of acoustic shows, and, you know, my acoustic shows become, you know, with a couple of players electrifying, using amps with, you know, acoustic guitars became a bit of a thing there for a sec. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. And in 2013, you started the Dead Daisies. I love that name.
Thank you.
What were you smoking when you came up with that one?
Well, funnily enough, you know, I have a skull. It's like a Day of the Dead skull, and it's painted all these fabulous colours and stuff.
And the eyes,
these two daisies. So I'm sitting there trying to come up with names for the band, and there's all these different names, and I'm looking at the skull and going, oh, yeah, dead skull, dead daisies. So I wrote that down. And I remembered that, you know, when I went into hospital with my heart, I had a double heart bypass in 2009, September 2009. And I remember the surgeon, I remember lying in hospital, and the surgeon, I'd gotten a staph infection, so I had died from that as well. And I remember the surgeon coming in when I was, you know, feeling a lot better, saying to me, mate, you should be pushing up daisies. Mm. I never forgot we said that. So now you're still here. I've got no idea. You should be pushing up daisies.
Gee.
You know, and so the dead daisies sort of rang a bell, a chord, struck a chord with me.
Yeah.
When I actually, you know, said to, you know, David Lowy, who was my partner in the band at the time, when I was there, he hated it. He said, we can't use dead. We can't do that. We can't be called the Daisies, mate. So it's the Dead Daisies, trust me. And, you know, and we use the skull as the motif, and we go from there. And that's, so it all just fell into place. And,
I didn't know about your double heart surgery. I was in America, so I missed all this. What happened? Yeah. Were you on stage or...?
No, it was a hereditary condition. I went for a checkup. My father died from heart disease, and then
You
look through my family, there's plenty of it going on. But I just went for a checkup, and basically they sent me for a CAT scan. And 20 minutes after the CAT scan, I get a call from the doctor saying, John, what are you doing? And I said, I'm about to sit down and have lunch. I was in Bondi Beach.
Yeah.
And he said, get in your car and drive to Prince of Wales Emergency right now. I'm like, what? And he goes, don't stop and talk to anyone. Don't go home. And whatever you do, don't exert yourself.
Oh, my God.
There's a beautiful sunny day up on the beach. I've been to the gym that morning. I've been for a run from Bronte Beach to Bondi that morning, feeling great, feeling absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I get to emergency, and they start sticking things in me, and I'm sitting in a wheelchair, you know, what the hell's going on? And they said, you're about to drop dead. I said, what do you mean I'm about to drop dead? I said, you mean I'm going to have a heart attack, you know? And they said, no, you're about to drop dead. Your main left artery is 99.9% blocked. And
gee.
They call it the widowmaker.
Yes. And, yeah, I've heard that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it just so happened that I had that CAT scan, and they found it, because prior to that I'd had every other test, and they'd done the ultrasounds, I'd got on their treadmill, I'd done, you know, my blood pressure was normal, everything I presented as a perfectly healthy person, you know, and the CAT scan was the one thing that saved my life, actually, by doing that. because they can see right in and see what's going on.
Well, you just don't know, do you?
You don't know. But they have the technology. The thing is, it's the technology. Is, you know, even since 2009 has, you know, come leaps and bounds. So it's, you know, they can see this stuff, man. It's amazing. They're so amazing, these doctors, and all this technology they got. It's incredible what they can do now.
I'm speaking with John Stevens. Now, John, they say after, you know, double heart surgery and all of that, when you come out of it, there's a big depression, Dick. Did you go through that?
No, but they kept checking in on me and, you know, saying, are you okay? And, you know, we need to talk to somebody. And I, every time I'd say, okay, are you kidding me? I'm the luckiest bloke in the world. You know, I am the luckiest bloke in the world. So don't worry about me. I'm not depressed. I am grateful. I'm so grateful. Wow. You know, I just felt so blessed to, you know, because I watched my father, you know, when he would have heart attacks, you know, I'd be calling the ambulance. So, you know, it was a lot of traumatizing experiences from him having heart problems, you know, in the 70s when he was, you know, diagnosed with heart disease and, you know, it killed him a few years later. All they had was angina pills. You take this angina pill. That's all they had. They didn't know what was going on inside.
Yeah,
you know, it's crazy.
Well, I'm glad you're fitting well, and you're touring, you're doing festivals, you know, with this bloody COVID thing knocking out shows all around the country. But when it comes back, man, it's going to come back hot.
Oh yeah, we can't wait for that. You know, I've been getting a few shows in here and there, been lucky enough to, it's really crazy out there, isn't it? This world has changed immensely.
Yeah. Mate, tell me about your last album. You teamed up with Dave Stewart from the Eurythmics.
I've always been a big fan of Dave's. In fact, Noiseworks, we toured with the Eurythmics in the late 80s.
Yeah.
And I said to Dave when we met again years later to work together, I said, you know, when we were just shit-kicking little support band, I'll never forget that you were nice to us.
Yeah.
You talk to us, you know, we were nothing. We were nobodies. They were number one in the world. They were massive at the time. And I said, he didn't remember because he was whacked off his head last time, but he was so nice. He's such a nice man. And at the peak of his career, when he was a young bloke, you know, he was nice to us young fellas, you know, and gave us the time of day. And I never forgot that. I thought, mate, one day, you know, and we worked together and I said, aside from his amazing producer and songwriter and all that, the thing was that he was kind, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I remember Dave and Annie as the Tourists. And they were on Countdown.
Wow.
And then I think 3 months later they changed their name to Eurythmics and the world just became theirs.
Yeah, mad.
And the album you wrote... Yeah, Starlight.
Dave and I wrote a lot of songs on that album. Yeah. Drank a few martinis and, you know, he introduced me to his good friend, Ringo Starr. And Ringo played on the record.
Peace and Love.
Yeah, Peace and Love. And Ringo, you know, he asked me to sing at his birthday party. About 4 years ago.
Oh.
Yeah, so in Los Angeles, it was one of the highlights of my career.
Fantastic.
Obviously, having Ringo playing on the Starlight album was just amazing. He's such a gracious human being, beautiful man, and
an amazing drummer.
Amazing musician. Yeah. You know, but. You know,
it's an unusual style, but cool. My God, what you listen to those Beatles songs and he was brilliant.
Yeah.
Just brilliant. So all the albums that I've mentioned, the Noiseworks albums, the Dead Daisies albums, all available on the usual platforms, right? On Spotify, on CD Baby. And on your website, johnstevens.com.
There might be links to them. I don't, these record labels, different record labels, you don't get permission. So, it's all that rubbish. But you can find them everywhere else on Spotify, I guess. And, you know, I tell you the truth, mate, I've never looked. You know, I'm always thinking forward.
What's next?
Think about today and tomorrow. What's next?
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, everything shapes you. And obviously, you know, there's a massive body of work And, you know, I'm very proud of all of that stuff, but I never really think about it, to tell you the truth. You know, I mean, I love singing live and I love putting smiles on people's faces, you know, when they hear those songs and, you know, and it makes them, reminds them of, you know, when life was freer.
Yeah.
And when life was good, you know, and that's the wonderful thing about music. It helps you escape from whatever you're going through in your life. It's such a privilege to do what I do, and I never take that for granted. And you know, I always try and do my best.
Well, John, you're very humble, but you're one of the world's greatest singers, and I just
Thank
love
you.
What you do, and may you continue
Thanks
to
so
do
much,
so.
Kevin.
So, mate, before we end the podcast, we have 10 questions without notice.
Sure. Yes.
So, all right. First question: who inspired you to make music?
My parents, my family.
Okay, now, next question. What have you learnt over your musical journey?
Stay real. You know, what goes up must come down. So keep it real, man.
What was the effect of Countdown on your career?
Pretty substantial, actually. I did Countdown for the very first time in 1981, coming over from New Zealand, and I think I did Jezebel on there, and I was absolute nobody. And I'll never forget. I'll never, ever forget. Maybe it was 1980. I just three nights before, Elton John had played in Wellington, my hometown.
Uh-huh.
And I was at the gig and he got me up on stage and I jammed with him in front of like 30, 40,000 people.
Wow.
And, we did a Beatles medley and I never forget, when Elton introduced me, there was like this booing going on in the crowd. And I'm just a young kid, right?
Yeah.
And I remember Elton absolutely give it to the crowd, just gave it to them, said, what are you, you know? And that's when I realized, holy shit. You know, I was so overexposed in New Zealand as a youngster with those songs,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That, you know, I hated me, you know what I mean? And Elton, God bless him, he completely just, you know, just took it. And I got up there and the crowd turns around as soon as you start singing, you know, and have a good time. Everyone goes, ah. But that initial thing of being booed was like, wow. It was like a realization of, man,
yeah,
this shit is so fickle.
Well, yeah.
You know, but, you know, that's why you got to stay true to yourself always, yeah. You know, and true to, you know, what you do and who you are. And that's all, you know. On my journey, that's what I've learned.
People don't realise how supportive Elton John is to new.
Oh,
new
amazing! Lives. Oh, so rolling forward a few days, so I go to Melbourne to be on Countdown, and Molly had never heard of me, didn't even know me, right? But I'm on stage rehearsing, and Molly walks in with the entourage, and Elton walks in and sees me on stage.
Oh,
and,
perfect.
And he goes, hey, John, how you going? You know, he's like, oh, Elton, there you go, mate. And I never forget Molly's face. He's looking at me and he's going, who is this guy? Who is this guy? Who the fuck is this guy? You know what I mean?
Oh,
it was hilarious.
Oh, that's priceless. That's brilliant.
Yeah, I never forget. Yeah.
Next question. If you could open up a show for any artist, dead or alive, who would it be?
Probably Led Zeppelin. I love that.
Yeah, yeah, that would be awesome.
The Beatles, of course. I mean, you know.
Yeah, hey. They're all our influences, aren't they? Led Zeppelin and the Beatles.
Yeah.
All right, next question. Name three dinner guests, dead or alive.
Muhammad Ali, Gandhi, and I need four. Probably my mum and dad would be good. I'd like to see, you know. They died when I was young, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
Well, they would be there so you could ask all those questions you'd love to ask. Yeah. Good on you, mate. Now, question number six, what's your favourite song to perform?
Gee whiz. That's a hard... You know, I love performing Everyday People. It's a Noisewerk song off the Love Versus Money album. I don't sing it in my own shows, but when I'm playing with Noisewerk, we pull that song out. And I just, you know, I always love singing that song, you know. But I don't really have any real favourites. I just, you know, each song, particularly when I'm doing this Noisewerk NXS collection, it's just hit after hit, and just every song's like a memory, you know.
Yeah.
And that's where all the joy is. The joy is in the response from people hearing those songs as they, you know, that they grew up with, like I grew up with them, you know. And so you know, the joy is all in expressing that and having people respond.
I loved your Never Tear Us Apart at the Melbourne Cup.
Thank you.
That film clip that you did, that clip was amazing. And you were sounding the best I've ever heard you.
Oh, thanks, man. That was completely live. You know?
Yeah, I could tell.
Completely live. So, and you know, it was a beautiful day. And you know, it felt good. We'd been locked up for a bit. And it just felt good. Mm. I hadn't seen the band or any of the boys for months, I think, at that time. It was November 5th. We'd been locked down for quite some time. Since March, you know, up in and out, right, here in Melbourne.
Right.
So I hadn't seen the boys. And so that was the first time we played together in like months and months. And so we were so happy on that day. I think it probably came across in the whole performance, a beautiful sunny day. And it was weird with no people there, but, you know, the vibe within the band was amazing.
Yeah, and a tough one to do when you're that far away from the band and all of that. There's a lot of air between you all.
Yeah, you know,
and you and you nailed it. Next question:
Thanks.
What's the most trouble John Stevens has ever gotten into, apart from being belted by teachers who should be in jail?
You know, I got arrested, you know, on false charges, which were dropped, you know. That's about it. That's about the most trouble I ever got in. It was very, very emotional time, you know, breakup of a relationship and et cetera, and, you know, so that's probably the worst time of my life.
I hear you. All right, next question. If you could change anything about the music industry, what would you do?
Give power back to the artists.
Do you think it's coming back now with the internet?
Well, you know, Spotify, you know, they don't pay. You know, you read about, you know, the billions and billions of dollars all these companies make, but you know, the artists are the last ones to get paid. The creators of the music are the last ones to get, you know, their just rewards. So,
yeah, the government should bring in a ruling that the artists get a bigger slice. The artists and the songwriters more than anything.
Yeah, I remember in Ireland, I'm not sure if it's still the case, but certainly, you know, artists never pay tax. And I remember with U2, you know, being the biggest band in the world for all so many years, living it up, they never had to pay tax. So, you know, there's half your extra income. I think they might pay a little bit now, but I don't know, you know.
Yeah, I think they might have caught up with them.
Yeah.
Second last question, John. What's the best show that you've ever done?
Oh, my next one. You know what I mean?
Good on you. Good answer. Yeah. No, I understand that. And final question, what have you learnt and what would you pass on to a young, hopeful John Stevens?
You know, just stay true. Stay true to you. You know, write songs. Because whatever's coming out of you creatively is a part of you. And that's, you know, if you've got a voice, if you've got something you need to say or do or sing or whatever, you know, just persevere and you know, keep learning. You're always the student, never the master in this game. You know, you can never work it out. It's such a, being creative is something that just falls out of the sky. It's not something, you know, that, just it's a weird thing. It's almost spiritual at times for me.
Yeah.
You know, it's weird.
You got to believe, haven't you?
Yeah, you do. Believe in yourself.
John, I've been a big fan of yours for a very long time. I thank you so much for your time, and I can't wait to see you on the Red Hot Summer Tour, the Blues Fest, and all these great festivals that are just being pushed back and back and back, and I hope you get on stage real soon. All the best, mate.
Yeah, thanks so much, Gav. I appreciate it, mate, and likewise to you and yours. Cheers.
Gavin Wood's Countdown Podcast was thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.